I'm Christopher Lydon, with a chance here to put my last three simple questions about John F. Kennedy to his most esteemed living biographer. Robert Dallek wrote the mainstream classic, An Unfinished Life. First question, really, why do we love JFK so? For his brief and, in fact, scary term in office. We love him more than Ronald Reagan and much more than the other modern presidents. Second question, what was our reckless playboy president really up to at the core of his purpose, his being? Third question, why can't we know who killed him? The official answer is a lone nut assassin did it. Three out of four of us don't believe it. Here's one of the reigning presidential historians, Robert Dallek, on what we still have to learn from the real JFK. Bob Dallek, you are the recognized master biographer of John F. Kennedy in this indispensable book, An Unfinished Life. The unanswered question at the center of my mind is not just who killed JFK, it's really why don't we know 50 years later for sure who killed this man, who finished this life prematurely?
Well, we'll never know because it's now 50 years later and there have been so many theories, so many hypotheses, so many explanations that the thing is a total muddle at this point. Now, the Warren Commission, of course, said it was just Lee Harvey Oswald. And they left out all sorts of things about the FBI and the CIA. They didn't want to embarrass them. I think the assumption was that they should have known where Oswald was. After all, he was this strange character who had deserted and gone to the Soviet Union and was a Marine for a while. And so the assumption of the official committee, the official report, was that Oswald did the killing. And then all sorts of ideas came forward. Mark Lane, of course, writing about this and asserting that, but there are assertions that it was the Mafia, that it was the Castro Cubans, that it was the Vietnamese, because Ngo Dinh Diem was toppled and assassinated 3 weeks before Kennedy was killed. Anyway, it's a muddle at this point. We're never going to know exactly what happened, or at least let me put it this way. It may well be that Oswald was the only killer, but people will never be satisfied with that answer because they're left with a kind of puzzle. And you see, I think that whatever the truth, people can't accept the idea that someone as inconsequential as Oswald could have killed someone as consequential as the president. And they don't want to believe that the world operates in such a fortuitous fashion that this guy gets off these shots and is able to kill him. Now, you know, what was fortuitous about this is that the first shot that passed through Kennedy's neck would have toppled him, knocked him over, except for the fact that he was wearing a back brace. And the back brace held him erect. And the bullet that found the back of his head and killed him would not have done that if it weren't for the fact that the back brace was holding him up. So, you know, there is that sort of fortuitous fact that is part of the whole mix. But I guess the dispute will go on forever.
You know, life is a muddle in many dimensions, but for that to remain a muddle could drive the country crazy. Maybe it has. Let's take a couple of those alternatives. If the Mafia, on its own, for its own reasons, had killed Kennedy, they would attract that mystery to a solution. Similarly, the Cubans, or the Russians, or anybody. The one story that we won't allow to be true is the CIA military one, the idea that our own government did it.
Well, except, Chris, you see, if Bobby Kennedy, who was the Attorney General, if he were convinced that there was a conspiracy, that it was the CIA, or any of these alleged assassins or conspirators, don't you think he would have run this to ground? He wouldn't have let his brother's killers get away with this. And I think the fact that he never really pursued this, he probably himself was convinced that Oswald was the only killer. That is my supposition.
Well, his son now says his father never believed the Warren Commission, and he did take a very strange alternative course. No, I won't track it to ground. I'll capture the Hill again. I'll come back to power by running for president. That may have been folly right there.
Maybe. You know, I think this is the proverbial dead horse, so to speak. It's going to be beat upon and beat upon. And also, it feeds into what the historian Richard Hofstadter once called the paranoid style in American politics. And may just be that Oswald was the only killer, and people are not going to let go of that. But, you know, the country has lived with it 50 years, and it's going to continue to live with it. And, of course, the anniversary now has brought all this back into focus. But you see, what's really, to me, more interesting is the question of why John Kennedy has become such an iconic figure. After all, he was there as president for only 1,000 days. It was the sixth briefest presidency in the country's history. And yet, when you see polls, there was, for example, a few years ago, a Gallup poll asking people to assess the last nine presidents from Kennedy to George W. Bush, Kennedy had an 85% approval rating. The only one within hailing distance of him was Ronald Reagan with 74%. So the puzzle to me is, why does he have this extraordinary hold, not just on the American imagination, but around the world? Because I can tell you, in this time of remembering this 50th anniversary with, you know, my new book out called Camelot's Court Inside the Kennedy White House, I've been getting a million calls. Switzerland, France, Germany, Britain, Brazil, Japan, Russia, Denmark, Sweden, journalists from all over the world want to talk to me about this moment in history when 50 years after Kennedy's death. So, you know, he's a world celebrity. He's a world icon. And that's, I think, the more interesting question that is easier to address.
And how do you answer it?
There are a number of things at work. One is that, of course, he was assassinated. But that's not enough to explain his hold on people's imagination. You know, William McKinley was popular president, 1900, elected to a second term. 1901, he was assassinated. 50 years after his death, hardly anybody remembered who he was. So other things are going on here. Part of it is television. The fact that Kennedy is frozen in our minds at the age of 46. Nobody can imagine if he were alive now, he'd be 96 years old. And there are the live televised press conferences, taped televised press conferences. He's so witty, charming, engaging, so young. But you see, most of all, I think it's two things. One is the fact that people have been so tremendously disappointed in the subsequent presidents. Lyndon Johnson with Vietnam, the failure with Vietnam. Richard Nixon, the horrors of Watergate, the only president in history to have been compelled to resign. Ford's truncated presidency, Jimmy Carter's flawed, failed presidency, the two Bushes with the second Bush leaving under a cloud because of Katrina, the recession, and no weapons of mass destruction, and a war in Iraq that we probably didn't need to fight. So they don't like these other presidents, and they need some hero. They need somebody they can turn to. And what Kennedy gives them is a better future, so to speak, because you can write anything onto the slate you want. It's tabula rasa. And they remember his words, ask not what you can do for your country. He promised to put a man on the moon, and that happens. He calls his administration the new frontier. So in a sense, he's the embodiment of something better. You know, my teacher for my doctorate was a man named Richard Hofstadter, a brilliant historian, who once wrote, "America is the only country in history that believes it was born perfect and strives for improvement." In a sense, that's what continues to happen here. We reach for something better.
The other night, Bob Dalek, you and I were watching clips from this PBS series on JFK, and you made a wonderful remark. There were pictures of him with the Pauls in Wisconsin in 1960, And you know, every other guy on that scene looked like somebody out of an old-time movie. And JFK looked like he walked out of today. There's something eternally modern about that man. I mean, the way Shakespeare is eternally modern, or, you know, Mozart is eternally modern. There's something. Describe what you saw.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point. He looks like us. If he, you know, walked into the room I'm sitting in now, he would look like a contemporary, someone I would know, I'd be comfortable with, you see. It's not as if, you know, he's some guy from the 19th century with a high collar and appearance that is no longer recognizable on the streets of Washington or New York or any city in this country. So, yeah, I think your point is very well taken. He has a kind of, you know, there's the eternal flame at his grave, and it's a kind of eternal image, is the way one might put it. But, Chris, what one needs to think about is 50 years from now, neither you or I assume will be here.
I'm going to try.
I'm doing fine, too, but I'm 79 years old, so I'm not banking on another 50 years.
That's so, a spirit.
Anyway, will Kennedy still be such an icon? At a 100th anniversary of his death, will there be this kind of recognition and memory of him? I think a lot of it has to do with, of course, what happens in the future in this country. If another president comes along who generates the kind of enthusiasm and hope and expectations that Kennedy still generates, he'll eclipse Kennedy. But if not, and the country continues to stumble and struggle, in 50 years from now, he may still be the icon that he is today.
Yeah. I want to extend this question of the cult and the fascination with a different question, actually. And I want your view of it as an historian. There's something like a gathering consensus out there that John F. Kennedy, in his last year, between the missile crisis and his assassination, was waging peace with the intensity that people wage war. I mean, he was in a consuming drive for peace. Find a way out of Vietnam, reopen some sort of a pragmatic but maybe simpatico conversation with Fidel Castro, and end the Cold War, starting with back-channel talks with Nikita Khrushchev. This is one picture. Jeffrey Sachs has written about it. James Douglas, in another way, has written about JFK, his personal experience in the Pacific, his blunder in the Bay of Pigs, his near-universal catastrophe in the missile crisis, suddenly ignites something, and he's hell-bent to make peace for the world. That American University speech is the touchstone. Does this make sense to you, Bob Dalek, as an historian, a biographer, that this was what Kennedy was about in his crowning moment, in his final year?
Absolutely. Indeed, you know, I published an article out of my new book in The Atlantic called JFK versus the Joint Chiefs. And what I describe in there is the fact that he had grown terribly suspicious of, doubtful about the wisdom, the good sense of his military advisors. Now, you're quite right. This goes back to the Southwest Pacific when he was in the Navy and he saw these naval officers who he didn't think very well of. And then the Bay of Pigs operation where he feels terribly misled by the CIA and the military chiefs. And he walks around afterwards saying, how could I have been so stupid? And the missile crisis in which the chiefs are urging him to bomb and then invade, and he resists, and he resorts to diplomacy, which of course gets him out of that crisis and resolves it in a reasonable way. And then he and Khrushchev, recognizing how close they had come to a disastrous nuclear war, reached the agreement on a nuclear test ban. At the same time, Kennedy is so leery of the possibility that it could be a nuclear conflict. This is the greatest horror to him. And indeed, he says to this young mistress, this Mimi, who spends one night with him at the White House during the missile crisis, he says to Mimi, I'd rather my kids be red than dead. He never could have said that in public, but that was his, one might say, revisionist thinking, because he had begun as a Cold Warrior, you see, and he becomes more mindful of this idea that he'll be the one who'll be responsible if there's a nuclear war it will go down in history as John Kennedy, the cold warrior who killed hundreds of millions of people. You know, at the beginning of his term, he wants to rein in the military who control nuclear weapons, or the local commanders. Mac Bundy tells him they could touch off a nuclear war if there's an incident with the Soviets. So Bundy calls up the general of the Pentagon and says, we want to see the nuclear war plan. The general says, we don't show that. Bundy says, hey, you don't understand. I'm calling for the president. Anyway, they give Kennedy a briefing. They talk about how they would drop 170 atomic bombs, nuclear weapons, on Moscow alone. And they would kill hundreds of millions of people in Russia, Eastern Europe, China. And as Kennedy walks out of the room, he says to Dean Rusk, he says, and we call ourselves the human race, you see. So the crowning moment here is after the missile crisis is ending, he meets with the Joint Chiefs. And one of them says to him, Mr. President, you've been had. Khrushchev is hiding the missiles in caves. They leak this to the press, and Khrushchev writes him a note and says, I don't live in the caveman age. I'm no caveman. They want to plan to bomb and invade because Khrushchev is lying to you. Kennedy says, well, go ahead, make plans, you see. So they plan the possibility that they would drop a nuclear weapon on Cuba. And they talk about how you can avoid the collateral damage, what it would have done to the south coast of Florida, how it would have radiated the south coast of Florida, let alone turned Cuba into a pile of rubble. And Kennedy thought they were nuts, that he just didn't subscribe to any of this. And so that peace speech at American University, which is a great state paper, was an expression of his idea that we need to rethink the way we look at the Soviet Union. See, I think if he had lived, that we would have gotten to detente sooner than we ever got there with Richard Nixon. Also, I studied this very closely about Vietnam. We'll never know exactly what he would have done about Vietnam. It's crystal clear he didn't want to lose Vietnam. He remembered the Who Lost China attack on the Democrats by McCarthy and the Republicans. He didn't want to be accused of that. But by the same token, he did not want to send in massive numbers of ground troops. So he kind of compromised. He increased the number of advisors from 600 to over 16,000. What he would have done, we'll never know. He didn't know. But I don't think he ever would have put in 545,000 ground forces the way Lyndon Johnson did.
Bob Dalek, this is so incredibly fascinating, including what he said to Mimi, the mistress. I mean, better read than dead. It's funny how fundamental that is. I was in the Yale class that Kennedy addressed in 1962. We lived in that culture. I have friends from those days who still remember. We were the only two guys who would rather be dead than read. Everybody wanted to be alive and get through that. And for the president of the United States to get it down to a, you know, five words or whatever is so fascinating. Let me ask two final questions to bring this together. We talk about this abiding love of John F. Kennedy, despite so many flaws. How much of that derives from this sense of his passion for peace?
Oh, I don't know that it derives so much from that, Chris. You know, people don't remember what a president does. You think they remember that Theodore Roosevelt put the Food and Drug Administration into place, or Wilson was the architect of the Federal Reserve. You know, the guy who said, I don't want the government fooling with my Medicare. Do they know that the federal government, that Medicare is a federal government program that Johnson put in place? I don't think if you went out in the street and asked people, what did John Kennedy do as president? Maybe they remember the missile crisis. But that's about it. So you see, I think it's really celebrity. It's a kind of halo that, and it's also the Kennedy dynasty. See, people are so drawn to the Kennedys, not the Roosevelts, not the Bushes. The Kennedys are America's royal family. And I think there are twofold reasons for this. One is that they are the embodiment of the American success story. The Irish Catholics who become fabulously rich and famous. And on the other hand, they're star-crossed. The older brother killed in the war, the older sister killed in the plane crash, the president and Bobby Kennedy both assassinated, the son killed in a plane crash, Jacqueline Kennedy dies of cancer in her 60s, Ted Kennedy with the a tragedy at Chappaquiddick, they're star-crossed. And people identify with loss and suffering as well as with fame and success. And the Kennedys, in a sense, embody both those things. So it's also the Kennedys en masse and Jacqueline Kennedy and her glamour. And I think that's really more it than the whole idea that he was. Although I'm hoping that my book will contribute to this understanding that he was, his greatest achievement, I think, was this reach for peace, was this denial of the possibility of fighting a nuclear conflict. I think that was his greatest achievement.
I think it's part of the popular understanding of the man, but here comes the punchline question. How much of that passion for peace and the drive of his last year accounts for his death? James Douglas has written, to my mind, a very thoughtful book that it was his open warfare with the CIA and with the military guys who wanted to attack the Soviet Union and Moscow with nuclear weapons preemptively, that this was what brought on his assassination.
Well, Chris, I can't answer your question. I certainly don't know. And you know what? I hope the supposition is wrong, because what a blow to the country's institutions. As it is now, the country has so little confidence in the institutions. Congress has an 85% disapproval rating. They don't believe that government, you know, I've had dinner four times with President Obama, with other presidential historians. And I mentioned that this Affordable Care Act, I said, it humanizes, it's another advancement in humanizing the American industrial system, which is what the New Deal originally did, see, humanize the industrial system. And so, but we struggle in this country. There's such little confidence in the federal government and in federal authority, and it would be a terrible blow if anybody, now, I'm not saying, you know, you don't pursue and look for the truth, absolutely. John Quincy Adams said, the historians, only religion is the truth. It's difficult to get at, but that's what you, you know, reach for. But I don't know that we'll ever find out much more about the assassination than we already know. Although, you know, there are 55 boxes of Robert Kennedy papers still locked up in the Kennedy Library. Maybe there's something there. Maybe. I don't know.
But what if it's all one big mass of anger, confusion, lack of information? Go back to this loss of confidence, loss of morale in ourselves, in our government, in our republic, in our ideals. What if that is all wrapped up with the fact that we can't find out who killed the prince of our youth and that they won't tell us?
Well, Chris, I can't imagine it's all wrapped up in that. There's so much more that has disillusioned people, like, you know, the failed war in Vietnam and Nixon lying to the public and Watergate and Bill Clinton, you know, waving his finger and saying, I did not have sex with that woman. And people, presidents losing their credibility. Nixon saying in a press conference, I am not a crook. You know, a president who has to tell the press in the country, I'm not a crook, his leadership is kaput. He's finished. See, so I think there's a lot more going on than just Kennedy's assassination.
Last question, Abdallah. What's your own measure as an historian, as a citizen, of what we lost in John F. Kennedy?
Well, what people feel they lost was, in some ways, the country's youth, the country's promise. And I think that's why they still are so attached to him, because they want to recapture that sense of possibility, of hope, of a better future. And of course, what feeds this now is the fact that there has become such a divide in the economy, and that there are so many people who are struggling, and not just people who are unemployed or underemployed, but there's so much anxiety about will their children have a better future than they had, because of economic dislocation in this country. And of course, there's such a deep divide in our politics with these Tea Party folks and shutting down the government, and the sense that it's not working. It's not working. On the other hand, Chris, let's remember 1968, when the country looked like it was absolutely falling apart, and a French travel agent advertised, see America while it lasts, you see. Well, here we are in 2013, heading into 2014. We're still here. Doesn't mean we're going to be here in another 100 years. What I keep saying is I wish I could come back in 100 years. I'd like to see what happened to America and the world. But I don't think I can arrange that. If you can arrange it, let me know.
If you arrange it, I want to come with
you. Good idea.
Robert Dalek, it's a joy to speak with you on a central subject that you've enlightened for all
well,
of us.
Thank you.
An Unfinished Life, John F. Kennedy, and the new one, Camelot's Court, Inside the Kennedy White House. Robert Dalek, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Professor Dalek's answers aren't simple, and they're not exactly what I was looking for, but they do connect in a plausible whole with passion. Dalek's reminding us that JFK, off the record, was a pillow talk peacenik with his 19-year-old mistress, Mimi Beardsley, in the White House during the missile crisis. Kennedy spoke the words that were officially forbidden during the Cold War. Better his kids should grow up red than dead, he said. The best way to see Kennedy's last year, Dalek says, is as an all-out peace campaign against nuclear suicide. JFK was at war with his own CIA and a lot of his own generals who were nuts, he said. But Dalek won't say, doesn't believe, and would hate to discover that it was the spies and the generals that set Kennedy up for murder. Dalek told me we love Kennedy for his star-crossed glamour, for so many accidental things like the fact that we never saw him grow old. But he leaves me wondering if we don't all cling to the Kennedy memory much more for the basic reason Dalek admires him above all, that he stared down a very possible nuclear catastrophe, and that he broke the nuclear madness of 50 years ago with his melancholy realism about war. Mary McGrath produced and edited this conversation with Robert Dalek. His new book is Camelot's Court, Inside the Kennedy White House. Check out the other reflections we've been recording on the 50th anniversary of John Kennedy's death with Jeffrey Sachs, James Douglas, and Stephen Kinzer, and we'll have more. And then weigh in with your own thoughts about John Kennedy, his life, and his death at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of this open source podcast project.